I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The city of Philadelphia is shutting down schools and city offices in advance of a major winter storm expected tomorrow. Managing Director Mike DeBerardinas says the city is taking extra precautions after a nor'easter slammed the region last Friday.
The National Weather Service is forecasting tomorrow's storm to include heavy, wet snow with the potential to down additional trees and power lines. Please be patient and avoid traveling during the storm.
And indeed, the major issue is heavy, wet snow, so the city is activating the snow emergency route system. That gets underway tomorrow morning at 8. They're also suspending trash collections for the day to allow for a full call-out of trash trucks to plow snow. This all comes as thousands of residents in our region are still without electricity after high winds brought down trees over power lines during last Friday's storm. The area that was hardest hit, Delaware County. And joining me now live on the line is the county's Emergency Management Director, Tim Boyce. Tim, thanks for being here on NewsWorks Tonight.
Oh, good evening. Thank you for having me.
So I'm sure you are still getting out from under from last Friday. Do you have a count of how many people are still without power?
Yeah, in Delaware County, we're still about 6,600 homes and businesses without power, representing about 3%. At one point, we had about half the county was without power.
To what extent might that gap close further before the advent of the next storm?
I think we're at a point where, and unfortunately for many people, the infrastructure damage in your local neighborhood, the telephone poles down, the requirement of work is going to be a slow process.
What are the preparations in place, for example, in the event of more trees falling?
Well, tomorrow we have upstaffed here in Delaware County. I know a number of the regional EOCs are also. We have PICO, we have the liaisons from the state police, and we actually have the National Guard represented here in case we have areas that we just can't reach it once again.
And I understand even forest rangers are being called in if needed.
Yeah, it was unique in Delaware County to have the lumberjacks here, but what they did is they played an important role in clearing streets and driveways. Unfortunately, after several days, a number of residents, doctor's appointments are delayed and can't get out. So they were out there clearing the streets, helping PICO, and I think in a lot of ways some quality of life issues for those that needed it.
Has there been a countywide declaration regarding municipal offices and schools?
Yes. Last Friday, Chairman McBlain and the members of council declared it. And what that allows at the county levels is us to purchase equipment, order equipment. We exceeded our capacity relatively quickly to support our locals. And it increased the funding and our flexibility to bring in staff.
Of course, that support for locals falls inordinately on those in need. And what's the status for example, hospitals, nursing homes, assisted living facilities?
Well, most of them, I'm happy to report just in the last few minutes that our last assisted care facility has come back to normal power. A number of facilities and just group homes have been cold, though. A generator will not fully support the building. So while you may have the life safety systems, it gets cold. And after, 5 days, it really is.
I'm sure motorists are well advised to avoid traveling tomorrow, but for those who either have to get to work or encounter some other emergency, what's the status of roadways and including traffic lights?
Most of the traffic lights are back up on our major intersections. It's been quite a hurdle. Backup power's running them. One of the things we are concerned with both the motorists in the morning and the snow plows, is some of the wires, some of the trees on the shoulders of the road are still there. You're not going to be able to see them. So if you go around, you pick up a cable, you pick up a wire that's buried a little bit, we're going to make a bad situation worse.
You don't have a crystal ball, but we do know that the winter storm warning extends until 3 a.m. Thursday. If power is not restored by then, might it extend well into the weekend before all customers have power?
Unfortunately, yes. I think that the amount of damage that we are looking at in our county is so significant that without the storm, we'd still be looking at some customers waiting till the weekend to get power. I mean, PICO has been an enormous partner in trying to get as many people back up. And fortunately, today, their representative, Joe Blackburn, who we deal with all the time, has kind of committed to serving those people in need, both physical help and those that are really just cannot take it anymore.
Tim, I'll let you go, but I have to ask, are you apt to get much sleep tonight, and what's your role for the duration of the storm?
My role is the power of prayer, like every day, but I like to think good thoughts. We're in a pretty good state to be ready, but it really falls back on our community to be resilient, to stay mentally well as physically well. And, you know, we'll get through this. We just need to be supportive of one another.
And many of our listeners, especially in Delaware County, will be praying along with you. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Okay. Good night. Thank you.
In other news this evening, the three Republicans vying for their party's nomination for Pennsylvania governor held a policy-focused debate this morning. As WHYY's Jim Saxa reports, the candidates differed more on style than substance.
Less is more. At least, that's what the three GOP candidates said on the debate stage at the National Constitution Center. Each argued repeatedly that less spending, less tax, and less regulation would mean more jobs for Pennsylvanians. To find savings, State Senator Scott Wagner said if elected, he would force agencies to rewrite their budgets from scratch.
I will immediately go to zero-based budgeting. And when we do that, I can assure you within the first year, we will find $1.5 to $4 billion.
On education, all the candidates said they want more charter schools. But attorney Laura Ellsworth added that the charter funding formula needs to be fixed.
Right now, we have a system where we are asking school districts to basically slit their wrists and bleed themselves to pay for these alternatives for other children. That makes no sense.
The Chamber of Commerce hosted a debate largely avoided social issues. But in response to a question on attracting new businesses, consultant Paul Mango attacked Wagner for co-sponsoring a bill prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity.
One thing I will not do is let people by gender identity come into our girls' locker rooms and schools in the name of generating business in Pennsylvania.
In response, both Wagner and Ellsworth defended the anti-discrimination bill, calling Mango's concerns unfounded. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Bill Cosby was in a Norristown courtroom again today as his attorneys and prosecutors hashed out disagreements over what evidence will be allowed during his second criminal trial that gets underway April 2nd. WHYY's Bobby Allen was in the courtroom to hear the debates and joins us now in discussion. Bobby, first off, we've been hearing about the potential for 19 other women to take the stand against Cosby during this upcoming retrial. Did the judge decide in that regard?
No decision, but yesterday prosecutors made the case for why 19 additional accusers should take the stand. Remember, during Cosby's last trial last year, 13 women were asked to come and testify, but the judge allowed just one. This time around, prosecutors are hoping for 19 other Cosby accusers to take the stand against him. And, you know, that's out of more than 60 who have publicly accused him of sexual misconduct. Now, today we heard from the defense, and the defense's side is if you bring in 19 other women to testify against Cosby, they're going to have their mind made up before they even hear all the evidence, especially in this Me Too era. And that's coming from seven defense attorneys who Cosby hired. You know, they've been doing a lot of research. They're a seasoned bunch. And their basic rebuttal to the 19 possible additional witnesses is don't bring this in. It's going to make the process unfair to Cosby.
Of course, the defense started trying to scuttle the prospect of a retrial in general. Now they're being asked to prepare for the potential of having to have these 19 additional witnesses.
If the 19 additional accusers come in, the defense says that's basically going to be like 19 mini trials. It's going to be a huge distraction. And remember, the criminal trial is over one alleged incident. There's three crimes tied to one incident from 2004. If you're hearing from that accuser, Andrea Constant, who's at the center of this criminal case, and 19 other witnesses, the defense says they're all going to get conflated together. There's going to be a lot of distraction, and they won't be able to focus on the ball, which is did or did not Bill Cosby sexually assault Andrea Constant.
Bobby, what is the legal bar for prosecutors whereby these additional 19 can testify?
So generally in criminal trials, what's known as prior bad act witnesses aren't allowed in, right? So Dave, if you're on trial for stealing your boss's pencil and the prosecution says, we want to bring in three witnesses who will say Dave stole pencils from me in the past, generally you can't bring that in because under the theory, well, if we hear from three people whose pencils you have stolen, the jury's going to automatically say happened once, happened twice, happened three times, probably happened again. That's called character testimony. You can't bring in prior bad act testimony if it's about character testimony. Now, there's a lot of exceptions. And today's court hearing was all about the legalese getting into the various ways in which you can bring in past accusers of Cosby in a way that's legally permissible. Like, if it can be proven that a defendant acted in a very signature way. For instance, a robber always wearing a red scarf. Or if the prior behavior happens time and time and time again, that there's no probable way it was an accident.
Now, I understand there was back and forth between both the prosecution and defense teams over the appropriateness of bringing up details around the civil lawsuit that was settled with Constant.
Right. So during the first trial, key parts of the testimony, including the now famous line that Cosby obtained quaaludes with the intent of giving them to women he wanted to seduce. Yeah, that line came from a civil deposition that was part of a civil lawsuit Andrea Constant filed in 2005. Now, the jury then heard those portions, but they had no idea it came from a civil lawsuit. Right before today's hearing ended, there was a back and forth where both sides agreed that the jury this time will find out that there was a civil lawsuit filed, that they will hear key portions of the deposition, and they might even know how much money Andrea Constant got from that settlement. It's so far been a closely kept secret. Nobody really knows how much money she got out of this civil lawsuit. And I think the defense will really underscore the financial reward as a way of saying that Andrea Constant was this money-grubbing person who was always after Cosby to get rich.
During yesterday's pretrial proceedings, your colleague Laura Benchoff assessed Cosby's demeanor as stoic. Any change today?
Yeah, I mean, I think today he was similarly sort of impassive, showing very little signs of feeling or emotion. There was one break in that impassiveness, which is when the judge, after 2 hours of court, said, "Are people squirming out there? Do we need a break?" And we all said, "Oh, just continue till lunch, just continue." And he said, "Mr. Cosby, how are you feeling?" And he blurted out, "I've been squirming." To which the whole room sort of erupted in laughter. So that was kind of a little glimpse into the, you know, the sort of comic legend that we all know as Bill Cosby. But besides that, he was pretty stoic.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Bobby Allen, who will be on hand during the entire trial next month. More sexual harassment claims are filed in the restaurant industry than in any other field. That's according to data from the U.S. Economic Employment Opportunity Commission. The Me Too movement has outed some celebrity chefs, toppling them from their restaurant empires, but change for non-celebrities is slow. One group is trying to change that in Philadelphia, as WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports.
It's an hour before customers will start arriving at Philly Tacos, a small storefront restaurant in South Philly. Juliana Sarita, with Women Organized Against Rape, has turned the dining room into a temporary classroom. She's speeding through a training on sexual harassment in Spanish so attendees can pick up their children from school.
I'm so sorry that I'm not going to translate the entire training because it will take 2 hours. But
Sarita is a part of the newly formed Coalition for Restaurant Safety and Health, a group of advocacy organizations that have banded together to try to prevent sexual harassment in restaurants. This is their first workshop, and they're starting small. Only about 10 workers, business owners, and advocates are here. Sarita projects PowerPoint slides onto the restaurant's dark teal walls. She explains there are two types of sexual harassment recognized by law. The first is called quid pro quo.
Quid pro quo, que significa dame esto por aquello.
That's when someone demands sexual favors or attention in exchange for a benefit, like a better shift. The other is creating a hostile work environment. Sarita says even if the person doing the harassment is a customer, the employer is liable if they don't do something.
El cliente es el que está usando. El empleador tiene que tomar cartas en el asunto.
The timing of this initiative, coming on the heels of the Me Too movement, was purely coincidental. Nadia Hevka is an attorney with Community Legal Services who helped get it off the ground. She says sexual harassment in restaurants has been on her radar for years.
The idea came from a number of folks around the city who were working with workers who had gone through sexual harassment situations. We noticed that a lot of complaints were coming from restaurants.
But she says the attention paid to sexual harassment right now is an opportunity. The idea is to make sure workers not only know they have legal rights if they're harassed, but to try to teach them to intervene and prevent harassment in the first place.
It's not just important for managers and supervisors to know about sexual harassment and what to do. It's really important to have everyone trained because you want everyone in your workplace to know what to do in case of a problem.
And by all measures, there are a lot of problems. A 2012 survey of Philadelphia food service workers by the Restaurant Opportunity Center found that a third had experienced sexual harassment at work. The coalition's goal is twofold. First, to get more restaurants to adopt sexual harassment policies. And second, to educate workers about what sexual harassment is and how to stop it. Mary Garten is a server who moved to Philadelphia from Burlington, Vermont a couple of years ago. We met up at a coffee shop in Kensington near the soup joint where she works now. She reached out to members of the coalition after she'd asked her manager at a tavern in Conshohocken to help her.
And I went over to him and I was like, hey, that regular just grabbed my ass. And it made me really uncomfortable. I was like, I don't really want to serve him. I don't, like, will you intervene?
Instead, her boss made things worse.
And instead, what he did was grab my ass and say, oh, like that? And so I quit.
Garten was at that training at Philly Tacos and now hopes to be one of the people who will take what she's learned to other restaurant workers in the city. She says she knows the difference sexual harassment policies can make because they were standard when she worked in Vermont. The coalition's next step is to get more employers on board. Their pitch? These policies can help shield restaurant owners from lawsuits and may reduce turnover. Juan Carlos Romero owns Philly Tacos and was the only restaurant boss at that first training. He says restaurants have a notoriously macho culture, and it's accepted that that's just the way it is.
No sé, somos machistas o...
He says he'll adopt an anti-sexual harassment policy, even though his business is small, because it'll help create a welcoming environment for anyone who comes in. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
This week, Philadelphia's modern ballet company, Ballet X, premieres two works by visiting choreographers. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that both of them are rooted in music remembered from childhood.
Back in the 1980s, Darrell Grant Moultrie grew up in New York's Spanish Harlem.
I was raised in an African-American household with R&B, gospel, rap. But when you go outside to the store, to the barbershop, you heard merengue, salsa, reggaeton, flamenco.
Today, Moultrie is a successful choreographer. He was commissioned by Ballet X in Philadelphia to make a new piece, and he wanted to celebrate the music that energized the neighborhood he grew up in.
It was like the 80s when crack was a big, big problem, you know, those years. And to watch it change now, it's very interesting. You can gentrify it, you can do whatever you want, but in the deep pockets, where they can't get the people who have been there, they can't get them out yet, you still hear the rhythms, the cultures, the traditions are still there.
Also on the bill for the Ballet X performance is the premiere of another new commission, this one by Trey McIntyre, who grew up in Wichita, Kansas. It was the 1970s, and he recalls a childhood where he would alternate between escaping into soul music and living in mortal fear.
On Saturday morning, I would watch American Bandstand, I would watch Soul Train, and like see it as otherworldly and the thing that I would aspire to. At the same time, one of the predominant memories was how many serial killers there were. Like in Wichita, it was the BTK Strangler. You know, every night in the news, there was some like report about that. And like my dad would literally say, go to bed or the BTK Strangler is going to get you.
To choreograph his piece called The Boogeyman, McIntyre rewatched hours of footage from Soul Train and picked apart the extravagantly funky dance moves, using them as a basis for a modern ballet. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
¶¶ That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Even after recent societal achievements of the LGBT community, being openly transgender can be difficult. So imagine presenting as the opposite sex in 1782. That's the subject of Alex Meyer's book entitled Revolutionary, about his ancestor Deborah Sampson, who disguised herself as a man to serve in George Washington's army. We'll talk to Myers, who himself is transgender, on tomorrow's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.